It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Coming up, the search for survivors continues after a deadly building collapse near Miami, Florida. We'll talk with a structural engineer about what may have happened and what we can learn to prevent similar disasters.
Now, the pandemic has taken a toll on mental health for a lot of people, and that includes children.
According to research from the CDC, the number of mental health-related emergency room visits for kids under the age of 11 rose by nearly 25% between last April and October, and that's compared to the same time frame in 2019.
In a new piece, our next guest spoke to people in the mental health community who say they're beginning to focus on younger kids who have seen a growing need for mental health care, but not always a lot of access to that kind of care.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a young person who's dealing with stress or anxiety during the pandemic? Or maybe you're an adult and this sounds like a young person in your life. If you're a parent, how did virtual schooling affect your child's moods? If they plan to go back in person to in-person school in the fall, how are they dealing with that? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Christina Caron covers mental health and the intersection of culture and healthcare for the Well section of the New York Times. Her latest piece is titled 8-Year-Olds in Despair: The Mental Health Crisis is Getting Younger. Christina, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
According to some of the people you talked to, Christina, we hadn't always thought of kids under 13 as being vulnerable to mental health problems. Can you talk about how that's changing?
Yeah, absolutely. So actually, a lot of people might assume that because of this, some of the more recent studies that have come out, that this is a problem that's related directly to the pandemic. But actually, if you look at the data going back to 2016, the truth is that the number of kids who have been coming into the ER who are under 13 for mental health reasons has actually been rising year over year. And as one doctor told me, it's almost like the pandemic threw gasoline on embers that were already glowing. So this has actually been a problem for quite some time. And there's a lot of reasons for that.
What are some of the reasons behind that?
Well, initially, I think one of my big takeaways is that we need more preventive efforts. We need better screening in schools and also in pediatricians' offices to start identifying kids who need help earlier so that they never have to end up in the ER. Right now, the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends mental health screening for all children 12 and older during well child visits, but it's actually not standard practice to screen children who are younger than that. And among the younger kids, unfortunately, there are a lot of unmet needs. Kids who are struggling with underlying psychological problems, but who aren't receiving treatment. And this is in part because finding a provider can be pretty difficult. There's a shortage of child psychiatrists. And actually, all types of mental health providers report being busier than ever, especially now during the pandemic. I think I'd also be remiss, though, if I didn't also mention social media and how that can affect a child's mental state. Now, that wasn't actually the focus of my piece, but it was really interesting how often it came up in my interviews. And it seems that kids are either getting ideas about how to harm themselves from these platforms, or they are, in some cases, just kind of fixated on people who are talking about really dark, difficult stuff that does nothing to help their mood improve, or in fact, it may actually have the opposite effect. So that's definitely something for parents to be mindful of, because for many kids, screen time restrictions have been loosened during the pandemic.
And Christina, you share some stories from kids who are experiencing this. Can you tell us a little bit about a kid you report about? You call her Marie, not her real name. Can you tell us her story?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. So Marie is an 11-year-old, and she had actually been doing pretty well prior to the pandemic. She didn't have any diagnosed psychiatric conditions. She was just kind of a normal kid, right? Who was doing okay. But then the way she described it to me was soon after the lockdown went into effect, she ended up kind of experiencing a lot of loneliness sadness. She was sort of growing apart from her friend group, and particularly one of her best friends. And that was pretty distressing to her. And as she continued to be kind of isolated, not attending school, not really socializing in person with friends, although she was seeing them on video or texting, it wasn't the same. And she just started having various anxieties, worrying about losing other people in her life, you know. And one weekday afternoon in October of last year, she was going on this walk. She was telling me she had been having nightmares during this time, like really vivid nightmares. And she just, during this walk, while she's listening to music, she just starts to get really upset, and she isn't really sure why. And she knew, she told me she knew she needed help, but she didn't know who to go to. So she just searched for a suicide prevention hotline on her phone. And at the time, she didn't know if the crisis counselors would really take her seriously. She was telling me when I interviewed her that she thought they might think it was a prank call, or that, you know, she thought she wasn't somehow deserving of making that call. And they, of course, did take her very seriously. And the counselor ended up conferencing in Marie's mother, Jackie, who was actually 25 minutes away by car. And they came up with a plan. They kept Marie safe until Jackie could arrive. And then, you know, the next day, Marie had told her mother that, you know, she had at one point brought scissors into her bedroom with the intention of hurting herself. She just didn't know how to do it. And her mother was shocked, just had not seen this coming. Marie told me she herself hadn't imagined that she would call a suicide hotline that day. It wasn't something she had premeditated. She just kind of did it in the moment. She's doing a lot better now, by the way, I should add. She did eventually start going back to school, and that was helpful for her, although for some kids that actually brings a lot of other anxieties. But in her case, it was particularly helpful to start having those in-person interactions again. She's had a lot of conversations with her mother. She's really opened up to her in a way that she didn't in the months prior, and that has been a huge source of help. But I think making that call was just kind of her way of sort of sounding the alarm, so that the adults in her life could know that she was really struggling in that moment.
Christina, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today.
You're welcome.
That's Christina Carone, reporter for the Well section of the New York Times, who covers mental health. We talked to her today about her recent reporting on young kids struggling with mental health effects of the pandemic, and as you heard, even before the pandemic, and a lack of resources in some places available to help them. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255. Anna Moffitt joins us now. She's executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Dane County. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, hearing Christina's reporting there, Anna, do we see similar things going on here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely, 100%. We see similar trends. I appreciate that she did reference that the place where we were at pre-pandemic really wasn't good either, and we were seeing steady increases in children and youth identifying as having unmet mental health needs, engaging in self-harm and suicidal ideation. And unfortunately, I believe the pandemic has made that worse over time.
For a parent who hears something like Marie's story and thinks, maybe that's my kid now, where do they start? How do they open up that conversation with a kid? How do they seek help?
Well, I think it's really important as parents and caregivers, which I am, is to actually normalize the conversation around mental health and mental wellness. So even before you notice something, just establishing those weekly or daily check-ins with your children and youth to see how they're doing. Now, of course, if you notice a dramatic change in behavior of your child or young youth, then you definitely want to say something and bring it up and not think that it's just going to go away. In particular, too, when we talk about suicidal ideation, based on data from 2017, about 50% of the individuals that were considering suicide actually had a plan. So you do want to talk to your children about things if you're noticing changes in behavior, emotion, sleeping, eating, these types of things.
Anna, can you talk about how to talk about mental health? I think a lot of us grew up in generations where you didn't talk about mental health concerns. It was a subject maybe to be avoided. If we were brought up that way, how do we have a healthy conversation with our kids so we don't just pass down that attitude?
Sure. Well, I think it's important as parents to talk about our own mental health. So even sharing early on, again, kind of preventative, just sharing with your child, wow, I'm really anxious today. I have this big work meeting. I don't know how it's going to go. I had trouble sleeping, or I'm feeling really down and depressed. One of my coworkers had to put their pet down. So starting to introduce that language early on. And then, again, it's okay to ask someone, are you thinking about hurting yourself? Or are you hurting yourself? Or are you thinking about killing yourself?
Actually, I want to ask about that point, Anna, because we hear the concern, if I ask that, are you hurting yourself? Are you thinking about hurting yourself? A common reason, as I understand it, that people don't want to ask that is they're worried it's going to introduce the idea. It's going to put that idea in someone's head. What do you say about that concern?
Well, that's one of the biggest myths out there around suicide, that if you ask someone about suicidality, that they're more likely to go through with that. And that's not how it bears out. And in fact, if you talk to survivors of suicide, many of them would say, I wish somebody had talked to me about it. And others have said, I didn't do it because someone said they were caring about me and they were there to help me. I think another myth around suicide is people think it's that somebody wants to end their life, and that's not the case when you talk with survivors. What survivors say is that they were in so much pain at that time, they didn't have any other idea how to get rid of the pain other than by completing suicide. So stepping in and being that supportive person and helping them work through the pain is the best thing that you can do.
We're talking to Anna Moffitt, Executive Director of NAMI Dane County, a group that works to improve the lives of people affected by mental illness. She's with us today to talk about how the pandemic has affected mental health for young people and how trends were going up even before the pandemic.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you struggle to talk about mental health within your own family? What makes those conversations so difficult to have? And do you have a way to talk about mental health with a young person that you have found works? Call in and share your experiences and questions at 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now about mental health for young people, especially, but not only, during the pandemic, and ways for families to work through mental health crises. Anna Moffitt is with us from the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Dane County.
We want to hear your experiences and answer your questions about young people and mental health at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org.
Anna, let's talk about available resources. I know we encourage people to seek help. Is the help out there?
I do believe that there's help out there. I would agree with the previous person is that there are longer wait times to seek professional help. So it's good to be prepared and act sooner than later. I would say, though, you know, being part of the National Alliance, that we provide a lot of services across the state of Wisconsin that are completely free, whether that's programming for parents to help better understand mental illness, programs for children and youth to also understand mental illness and mental wellness and how to take care of themselves. So those are some free resources, but it can be a challenge, and it can be even more challenging in rural parts of the state where you might not have reliable access to broadband. Services may be far away and hard to get to. And, you know, and just the wait times can be even longer.
To that point of rural areas, I just saw reporting our neighbors in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, if I read this right, zero available pediatric mental health beds, basically treatment options available in the entire peninsula. They have to go across a bridge or down into Wisconsin. Are there things that you would like to see to increase access to treatment, especially maybe crisis treatment in those rural areas?
Yes, and that's a big topic going on right now, and it's pretty consistent across the state, in particular for children and youth, that there just aren't enough beds for acute care and inpatient care. And so that's correct. People end up having to go to different states as well. If you're in southern Wisconsin, a lot of folks will end up in Illinois or Indiana. So really making sure we have an appropriate number of beds for inpatient care for children and youth, as well as for adults.
Now, we are approaching in just a couple months back to school time, and we've had a lot of kids who had, you know, a partial school year or maybe an all virtual school year. And I understand, Anna, that there are concerns, at least for some kids, about anxiety going back to in-person schooling. What kind of thoughts do you have on how parents and maybe educators can help ease that transition?
Well, I think it's going to be important for both parents and educators to prepare students for what are the routines and expectations, and especially, too, what are expectations around cleaning and PPE so that students can feel comfortable going into that space all together. And then I also think, too, really talking, again, having those open conversations about how are you feeling about going back. And again, for some kids, they might be really excited to go back to school. But for other kids who have experienced bullying at school or, you know, don't have the same social skills of other students, they may be even more anxious about going back to school. And I think, too, with this pandemic, you're going to have a lot of children and youth that are just worried not just about themselves, but about their families. If somebody gets sick, what if they bring home, you know, the virus, and feeling those kind of concerns.
Can you talk about coordinating families who know that their kids are maybe going to have trouble with that transition? How important is it to coordinate with the teacher or counselor or whatever resources might be available at a school?
Yeah, I really think it's important for parents and caregivers to know who are the designated staff who really are in charge of looking after, like, the social emotional needs of students. And if you have a child that you think might be struggling, reach out, whether it's a guidance counselor, a school social worker, the school psychologist, or maybe the classroom teacher from the prior year, and having that conversation early on, you know, maybe towards the beginning of August, reaching out and saying, hey, this is what's going on in our household. Can we get a plan together so that, you know, my child can return to school and feel good about it and feel less anxious?
Let's bring on a caller now. Mikey is with us in Madison. Mikey, hello.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that as a person who's gone inpatient multiple times, I've almost always found it to be extremely stressful and more of a place to where people will prevent you from committing suicide rather than a place where you will actually get help. And also, I think with just having therapy being provided, I think that there should be a lot of concerns about not just availability, but also the quality of that therapy. Because I know many, many people who have had terrible experiences with therapists. I know that I have had some certainly less than satisfactory experience with therapists.
Mikey, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. To her first point, Anna, you know, that inpatient thing is like the emergency room for a physical problem. You get that immediate care you need. How do we make sure that then we translate that into ongoing care that might help avoid the next visit?
Sure. I mean, I think that it is so important to have that continuum of crisis care. And I do appreciate what Mikey said about some experiences with some therapists. I think, too, what we're seeing is a lot of diversification of how people utilize therapy. For a long time, it used to be you sit on the couch, I sit on the couch. That doesn't work for everybody. So really being able to build out what does it look like to support someone's mental health needs. So I do think that's a very important point to raise. I'm sorry, now I forgot what I was talking about.
So you just mentioned her point about quality of therapy, but the translating, okay, you're in that inpatient acute situation. How do we make sure that care keeps going on even after the person leaves the inpatient center?
Right. And so with those inpatient center and within the behavioral health community, it really is important to have step downs and other supports within the community. So we know if you just walk out and you have no support, you're much more likely to be returning to inpatient. So having that intensive outpatient care, having day treatment, having other wraparound services to help that individual transition back into the community and manage their mental health needs successfully.
And Anna, can you leave us with a little more encouragement to maybe not be so Midwestern and be willing to talk about mental health issues with each other and with our kids?
Yeah, I mean, I think the important thing is, and whenever I go and speak with groups, I ask people, do you know somebody who has a mental health condition? And everybody raises their hand. So I think people just need to get over this idea that it's just me. It's not. We're all, and now especially coming through the pandemic, we're all coming through a very traumatic situation. And it's okay to not be okay, and it's okay to talk about it when you're not okay.
Anna, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
All right. Thank you.
That was Anna Moffitt with the Dane County chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, or NAMI. And earlier we heard from a New York Times reporter who covers mental health. They both joined us today to talk about youth mental health during the pandemic and what we can expect as many schools reopen in the fall. If you or someone you know is experiencing a mental health crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. The number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-8255.
Coming up, we'll talk with an engineer about the possible causes of a deadly building collapse in Florida and the lessons we can learn from architectural failures. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it may be the first Twitter thread to have been made into a movie. We'll meet its original author and those behind the making of the new film, Zola. That's 1A+, today at 6 here on the Ideas Network.
Now, emergency crews have temporarily halted the search for survivors in the rubble of a condominium near Miami Beach, Florida, that collapsed last week. At least 18 people have died and more than 140 people are still missing.
A 2018 inspection of that building called for repairs to damaged concrete in beams and walls, but it'll still take time before investigators are able to pin down a specific cause for the disaster.
Our next guest has studied building failures and how they can change the way we construct and regulate buildings. He says with careful inspection, the tragedy in Miami could make other structures safer in the future.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the building collapse in Florida? About what causes buildings to collapse in general? Have you lived in a building that had serious structural damage? Do you think we need more inspections and or enforcement of building safety codes? If you work in construction yourself, what do you think about, what are you wondering about when it comes to this collapse in Miami? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org.
Norbert Delott is a professor of engineering and head of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Oklahoma State University. He's the author of the book Beyond Failure, Forensic Case Studies for Civil Engineers. Norb, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So the question right now that's on a lot of people's minds is, how could such a sudden and drastic collapse like this happen, especially without any warning? Obviously, we don't know the answer to that yet, but what are some possible explanations that come to your mind with a building like this?
Well, there could be a lot of factors, and a lot of factors have been suggested. One that was pretty well documented in the 2018 report was the corrosion and deterioration of a building being for nearly 40 years next to the ocean. The salt air is in any infiltration of salt water, those are very damaging on building materials. So I think on the one hand, we know that we had a weakened building, but what we still don't know is what may have triggered the collapse, what may have led to that particular collapse on that particular day.
And you've written that there have to be, how does a building collapse? It really comes down to the right conditions, which you've kind of talked about, and the trigger. Do we have any sense right now of what the possible trigger could have been? We know, what the conditions might be playing a role, but what about the trigger?
Well, yeah, and that we don't know, and the evidence for that may be still buried under many feet of rubble, particularly if, as some have suggested, it initiated down in the parking area, down towards the foundation. But normally a trigger is something, some kind of event or overload, perhaps an impact. Again, there's no evidence of that. But it also could be some critical element of the building that weakened, corroded reinforcing bars that snapped, or a large chunk of concrete that fell off, or a column under a very heavy compression load where enough of the concrete fell off to cause a single column to crush. But that's going to be the hard thing to get to, because currently the clues are most likely down in the bottom of that pile.
And speaking of that pile right now, the rescue operations have had to be put on hold in part. We've heard some reporting that structurally it may not be very sound. It might not be safe for people. How is this going to impact, the investigation moving forward?
So, yeah, that's always an issue. I mean, in one respect, the good news is that part of the building stayed up, and that saved many lives. But unfortunately, that part is now unstable and kind of overhanging the site. That, in fact, was almost exactly the condition after the Oklahoma City bombing, where half of the building was still up and some parts of that were very unstable. That delays the rescue of any potential survivors. That delays recovery of victims, and the investigation really can't start until those operations are completed, because those are a higher priority. And so it's going to be a while.
And once those rescue operations come to a conclusion, what kind of things will investigators be looking at, as they're trying to basically piece together what happened?
So, you're looking at how the essentially how the rubble landed when it collapsed. And fortunately, I think even with drone footage, you can get that as you're digging down. Some points you want material samples. We want to pull out samples of the reinforcing steel to see how much of it was corroded, any fractures, how much of the section might have been lost. Also samples of the concrete. Was it quality concrete in the first place, but also have 40 years of salt, because the corrosion process is essentially salt and permeating the concrete and then eventually reaching the steel and weakening the reinforced concrete together. So material samples, positions of materials, how they landed, those are all going to be critical clues. The videotape, even though the quality is poor, showing the sequence can be extremely useful, essentially by being able to identify what seems to have come down first.
We are talking to Norbert Delott right now. He's a professor of engineering and the head of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Oklahoma State University. And he's with us to talk about that condominium collapse in Miami. We have a caller on the line. We have Jeff in West Salem. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I've heard in a couple of previous reports that the building had been sinking for years because of, whether it be sinkholes or, you know, the unstable ground because of the ocean level rising. And I was wondering if that had any bearing as to the investigation going on as to why it happened.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. And yeah, the condo is on the beach. It is close to the Atlantic Ocean. How much could that have been a factor in this?
Well, it's clearly a factor that's going to have to be looked at. But those tend to be gradual processes, which makes it less likely that it would lead to a sudden collapse. The other thing with subsidence is whether or not it's in one location or uniform. I mean, if the building sank even a couple of inches, but it all sank together, that doesn't put any stress on the structure. But if one part subsided, I mean, there are sinkholes in Florida. I just don't know that in this particular location, because you typically have very specific geology that goes with sinkholes. So while it's possible it needs to be examined, it can't be ruled out. The evidence leans much more to the actual deterioration of the structure itself. But since some of it seems to appear that it might have started from the bottom, I'm having to be careful because sure, we have not confirmed that yet. I think a foundation problem is potentially plausible.
We're talking to Norb Dalat right now, professor of engineering at Oklahoma State and the author of Beyond Failure, Case Studies for Civil Engineers. And he's with us again to talk about the condominium collapse in Florida last week.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about that building collapse in Florida or building safety more generally? Have you ever lived in a building where you wanted more transparency about the inspections, the status of the structure? If you work in construction or building safety, what are you thinking about as you look at that scene in Miami? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email ideas@WPR.org.
We will continue this conversation next here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Right now, we continue our talk with Norb Dalat, professor of engineering at Oklahoma State University, looking at last week's building collapse in Florida and what we can do to prevent future disasters. And in that vein of preventing future disasters, obviously, we still have a lot to learn about what's happening in Florida. But this is not the first building collapse to have happened, unfortunately. And you've actually written a book about all sorts of structural failures and the lessons we can take with them. What are some of the things that you think we might ultimately take away from what happened in Miami?
Well, I mean, because we'll be looking at, it was a 40-year-old building. We'll look at whether the codes in effect at the time were sufficient, but maybe weren't followed. We'll look at if we need to make updates to our codes. In many cases, the building codes have been updated based on what we find out from regulations like this. If the durability of the concrete in the structure were an issue, there have been a lot of advances over the last 40 years in those. But we may find that that we may need to make some further changes in particularly harsh environments where you've got that exposure of seawater and salt air. There have been some reports that indicate that there may have been water that intruded down into the parking area in the basement. And it's also possible that maybe some of the chemicals used, for example, in treating the pool, if those leaked out, that those, so we're going to try, those are the aspects we'll look at in terms of updating codes, but also maybe updating how we make concrete to make it last longer.
So, you know, as we have talked about, this is not the first time we've seen structural damage. And, you know, we're talking about what we might learn from this disaster. But of course, there have been other issues in the past. You know, what have we learned from those issues? Have there been any like big building collapses that we've seen in the past that have made our buildings safer today?
Well, for example, I think the Oklahoma City bombing made some major changes in how we design government buildings, where we have concerns that there might be some action against them. So for those types of buildings, you actually have to demonstrate that you could take away a column and the building would still stand up. I think the investigations of the World Trade Center improved maybe fireproofing, fire safety, improved maybe how we might do egress to get people out of tall buildings. So in many cases, there are things we learn. And usually, you know, the one thing that is useful is that I think we're going to have an investigating team from the National Institute of Standards and Technology. I think they already have people on the ground, and those people actually work on building codes, so they'll be able to take the lessons and put them in place directly.
So we've been focusing on what's happened in Florida. We've looked at some of the conditions that might have played a role, you know, the corrosive nature of salt water, sand, all of that. There are buildings that could be vulnerable in other parts of the country. In Oklahoma, Wisconsin, they might be more susceptible to various heat discrepancies. How are engineers like yourself looking at other buildings and their safety in other parts of the country?
Well, of course, we do look at structural safety around the country and around the world. A lot does depend on local conditions. And fortunately, the collapses of buildings in service continue to be very rare. Where there have been similar collapses of buildings like this, that has tended to happen during construction, because until a building is completed, it's not quite as stable. But you know, it's puzzling to have a building stand for 40 years and then something changed and it collapsed. And trying to figure out if that goes back to design or construction defects from the 40 years ago. And ironically, that area is one of the few in the country that have these types of required inspections, like in the 2018 report. Oklahoma, Wisconsin, I don't believe you have those kind of requirements. So maybe more periodic inspections. I think something to learn might be what some of the warnings of a building in danger might be and how we would go about identifying that and stabilizing it.
Not to make you speculate too much, but what might that look like? What might some of those danger signs look like in places that aren't Florida?
Yeah, well, so typical danger signs that you have, and for example, we talked about soil conditions and differential settlement where part of the building is settled. You're going to see cracks. You might have doors sticking, things of that nature. And if that appears suddenly and seems to get worse, that might be a reason to consider taking some action or even evacuating the building. And I think going forward, we might look at how if you have a building that is at risk, we're now getting to the point where sensors and monitoring systems are getting cheap enough that you would be able to put some kind of sensors in a building to monitor the behavior. So you could look at, for example, when a crack appears, does it get bigger, which indicates that the problem is probably getting worse. Another key indicator would be if a floor is at a level.
So that would be kind of just slightly off, maybe a little bit lower than a little higher at one point and a little bit lower the rest of the way. Is that correct at that level?
Right. And in particular, if you're seeing changes, you know, if it was level and now it's not anymore.
Yeah.
That's
that would,
the type of thing.
Yeah. That seems like that would be something you'd want to keep on your radar and keep your eye out. So we have about a minute left. What will you be watching for in regards to what we see coming out of Florida and potential next steps that people can keep their eyes on?
Well, the investigations take time. And typically in a case like this, it'll take about a year to actually get a thorough investigation report. That's, for example, what the National Transportation Safety Board how long it takes them to complete an investigation in something like the I-35W Minneapolis bridge collapse or other things like that. And so if with NIST investigating this, I expect we're probably in about the range of a, but if something comes out that's obvious, we may learn a lot sooner.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Norb, for joining us today.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Norb Dalat is a professor of engineering and the head of the School of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Oklahoma State University. He is the author of the book Beyond Failure, Forensic Case Studies for Civil Engineers. And he joined us today to talk about the deadly building collapse in Miami, Florida this week, where investigations are still ongoing.
Homicides were at their highest levels in decades in Milwaukee last year. They're on pace to break that mark in 2021. And some young people are facing regular encounters with gun violence. Corrine Hess reports that people fighting against gun violence in the city say there's more access to weapons now and that teens are still dealing with the effects of the pandemic.
Rodney Armstrong Jr. wanted to be a computer technician when he graduated from Washington High School in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood. His mom, Sheila Jordan, says the 16-year-old was a computer whiz. He also loved church and her, even getting Jordan's name and her birthday tattooed on his arm.
He would have been considered as a nerd. That's, I believe, why maybe people were able to manipulate him. Rodney was just a smart nerd.
Rodney was shot and killed on May 5th. While he was in the back seat of a car on Milwaukee's north side. Police haven't released any additional details, but Rodney's death wasn't an isolated incident.
We've seen a steady uptick, even pre-pandemic, of gun violence in this country. And so in Milwaukee in particular, this is something that, you know, has consistently been of concern for the city.
That's Reggie Moore, who heads violence prevention policy and engagement for the Medical College of Wisconsin. During the first 4 months of 2021, 7 children under the age of 17 were shot and killed in Milwaukee, and 27 more children have been injured in a shooting. Moore says there are a lot of reasons for the increase, but one undeniably is that schools have been closed, leaving kids with a lot less support. Milwaukee Police Inspector Paul Formolo says many times these cases involved youth who have gotten into fights on social media and then meet in person. Victims are sometimes engaged in what Formolo calls a, quote, high-risk lifestyle, which can include stealing cars, reckless driving, and dealing drugs.
We're going to need the help of the community. You know, it's just got to be a group effort to address the violence here.
Running Rebels is a youth mentoring agency that has worked with law enforcement, the court system, Milwaukee Public Schools, and Milwaukee County since the 1990s. The organization mentors youth in everything from suicide prevention to CPR to literacy and job training. Founder Victor Barnett recently led a summer employment workshop for nearly 80 young people. The group watched a video about self-control and discussed ramifications after. Dawn Barnett is Victor's wife. She says teaching young people how to control themselves in tense situations are some of the most important conversations mentors can have.
And these are the situations that lead to shootings. These are the situations that lead to road rage, that can they can end up losing their freedom or their life.
Barnett says people are afraid of what's happening in Milwaukee, but they're only getting a sliver of the story.
We see far more positivity in our young people. We see far more instances of young people making the right choices, not being the ones out there committing the shootings. So that's what we choose to focus on.
Rodney Armstrong was the youngest of Sheila Jordan's 8 children. Jordan says his pretty light brown eyes and smile lit up a room, and everyone wanted to hug her beautiful boy.
He was a very sweet, huggy kind of boy. He would always, I'm like, Rodney, be careful. I would always say that to him, be careful. And he would say, okay, Mom, I love you.
Jordan ran a strict household, especially during the pandemic. She didn't let anyone in, except family. But she had to work, so Rodney was alone most of the time, without school to structure his day. She felt something might be off in her son's life, but she couldn't put her finger on it.
Little things, but I don't even want to talk about that when I think that my child is now lying in a cemetery.
Jordan gets up every morning at 4 a.m. to work at a Milwaukee restaurant where she is a chef and a manager. When Rodney was younger, she brought him with her to work and then took him to school on the city bus to make sure he was safe. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow at 8, intimate partner violence affects millions of Americans, according to the CDC. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests talk about intimate partner violence and explore resources for people who are in toxic relationships. That's tomorrow at 8 on the morning show.
Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then text messages have become a big part of our relationships. We'll find out how relationships work one message at a time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.